From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what's in the National Opioid Settlement for Michigan? Some cash for drug treatment programs.
But also prevents more addictions from happening because they're going to change the way that these products are manufactured, distributed, and marketed.
Also, the founding of Detroit's long-lived and well-loved Black LGBTQ Pride event, Hotter Than July.
Not realizing what we was doing, the way we was entertaining, it was going to turn out for something like this. We were just really having a good time creating a safe space for ourselves.
Plus, we bust out the pontoon boat jams. Matthew Milia's new record delivers lovely, if angsty, odes to summer in Kego Harbor.
It's not a completely rose-tinted picture of the suburbs. It has to do with my complicated kind of relationship with suburbia.
Those stories just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we have a little something to add to your summer playlists. Singer-songwriter Matthew Milia's love song to Michigan suburbia. It's comforts, it's angst, and it's sweater vests.
It's a very personal record where I kind of show that the conflict, the internal conflict I feel right on the page, the good and the bad.
That's coming up later in the show, but first, Michigan's leaders are busy assessing the national settlement negotiated between a coalition of U.S. states and cities and four healthcare industry giants. Cardinal Health, McKesson, and AmerisourceBergen are all medical distributors. They, along with the pharmaceutical maker Johnson & Johnson, have agreed to pay $26 billion to settle lawsuits related to opioid addiction and its crippling toll on millions of people with addictions, including those in Michigan. Our state's Attorney General, Dana Nessel, joins us now to discuss the proposed settlement. Dana Nessel, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
First thing I want to underline is that this deal is not done. Parties involved, including all the states and all the cities, each have different rules about who signs off on negotiated settlements. In some places, the AG has more authority, and in others, the legislatures need to agree. Who needs to sign off on Michigan's piece of this?
Well, you know, we've been keeping the quadrant in the legislature advised about this really throughout the process so that they would know and understand it. And our expectation is they're going to be creating a fund, an account, that much of this money will go into. In terms of the municipalities and the localities, Michigan's situation is a little different from some other states in that the AG does have a little bit more authority than in some other areas. But we want to work as closely as we can with those municipalities. You know, they've been bearing the brunt of the costs associated with this tragedy for many, many years, and we want to make sure that there is a significant amount of money that's going directly to the municipalities. And so I have every confidence that the local units of government are going to agree to this. We're not going to have any issue with the legislature. I don't want to call this a done deal, but I think it's very unlikely that this will not go through in Michigan. And I also believe that we're going to get the full amount that we're entitled to, and there will be no sort of penalty for a lack of participation. Mm.
The deal proposes ending lawsuits against the four defendants. And I should say the company stressed that they strongly dispute the claims that they have culpability in our national epidemic. They're doing this, they say, in the interest of moving on. Can you remind us why you and your team do consider them responsible?
Well, first of all, I don't know any companies that pay a total of $26 billion that don't really think that they are responsible in any way, shape, or form. You know, the thing is, in a civil court, you don't have to admit or concede responsibility. In a criminal case, you know, when you're entering a guilty plea, that's part of the deal. You have to say, I take responsibility, I'm guilty of the following offenses, and here's why. You don't do that in a civil case. But to me, look what they've agreed to. It's not just the $26 billion and $800 million that will be coming directly here and to us in the state of Michigan, but it's all the other things that they agreed to as well. I mean, J&J is not going to be manufacturing opioids at all anymore. They've been put out of the opioid business for all intents and purposes. In terms of the distributors, there are going to be some pretty tight controls over the distribution process. There's going to be a monitor in place, and they'll be evaluating exactly how many pills are sent to different places, to different pharmacies. So there's a lot in this agreement that doesn't just provide for financial accountability to assist in abating the opioid epidemic in places all over the United States, but also prevents more addictions from happening because they're going to change the way that these products are manufactured, distributed, and marketed.
As you say, the estimates of Michigan's share run around $800 million. That sounds about right to you?
Yeah, we think it's going to be in that neighborhood, but I think it's important to note, you know, we still have a case that's being litigated against Walgreens. They're not involved in this deal. We had a previous case against a consulting company. We have other cases that we continue to negotiate with, Purdue Pharmacy. I mean, we're in negotiations with them, and we have a number of other manufacturers and distributors that we remain in negotiations with. So this really is just the beginning, but it's certainly a very important component of us moving forward and being able to treat those who are still suffering from opioid addiction today.
I did want to ask about that. Addiction and opioid overdose deaths are continuing. It's tough to get good data for 2020, given that the health agencies had so much on their plates last year. But the preliminary numbers seem to suggest that Michigan's overdoses rose a bit last year. And I know nationally deaths hit a record high. How will this money be used to address the harm?
Yeah, the numbers from last year were very upsetting. Some 93,000 people who they estimate died nationally from opioid overdoses. And here in Michigan, at least 2,800 people, if not more. So it continues to be a problem. I know it's been overshadowed, of course, in the last year by the COVID pandemic, but this has been a problem not for years, but for decades in Michigan. So you total up the number of people affected, and it's truly devastating. But what we wanted to do with this settlement, very different from the tobacco settlements of the 1990s, you know, that was a huge settlement. And we had a lot of money that came into the state of Michigan over the course of time, but the majority of it wasn't properly directed in terms of either abating tobacco usage or preventing future usage, the same way that we'll be doing with this settlement, where the money has to be used in accordance with this agreement. It has to be used directly in an opioid-related manner. When I say that, there's probably about 15 pages of this settlement that deal with the very many different ways it can be used, but it has to be in some way, shape, or form connected to opioids. So it could be drug rehabilitation programs or drug courts. It could go to the county jails when they're trying to treat people who have opioid addictions. It can go to the types of pharmaceuticals that emergency services often have to use to reverse an ongoing overdose so that the person doesn't die. Those are expensive drugs. And they're very badly needed by our emergency services all over the state of Michigan. Well, as I said, for a very long time, it is these companies that played such a significant role towards having this epidemic occur in the first place. They ought to pay the cost of helping to abate the epidemic and to, you know, assist those that are still suffering from opioids.
Beyond the cost of drugs that can make a difference in overdoses, which, as you say, those are considerable costs and widely used, the factors that lead people into opioid addiction include physical pain, you know, an untreated pain that they're dealing with, sometimes poverty issues or untreated mental illness. The legislature, as you say, is ultimately going to be the one to make those decisions. But do you think that $800 million really will make a dent?
Oh, I definitely think it'll make a dent. I mean, is it enough money? What's the cost of a human life? You know, I don't know that you can necessarily put a number on it. But I think for a lot of people who were suffering and just simply there was not a bed available for them to receive treatment, there wasn't a place to go, I think there is going to be a lot of help for people who couldn't have it. I remember being at a conference for the Prosecuting Attorneys Association in 2019 and listening to a couple of county prosecutors talk about the fact that they badly, desperately needed to have drug courts in their counties, but they just couldn't afford them, even though, you know, they were maybe $200,000 would be the cost of implementing a drug court. And we know that these courts are so impactful. They divert people away from the criminal justice system and into drug treatment programs, which is a win-win for everybody if those programs are successful. Well, they just couldn't afford it. Well, they can now.
Yeah.
And so I think that this money is really going to help a lot of people.
You say that you're feeling really confident that this deal is, at the end of the day, going to go through. I noticed your colleague in West Virginia, A.G. Morrissey, has already come out saying he thinks that this is a bum settlement, that it's a problem that the settlement is based on population affected in each area rather than the severity of the addiction problem in each area. Do you have any thoughts on that and whether concerns of that type have the potential to ground this?
I don't think at this point that's going to happen, but I will say for some of the states with smaller populations, because this is in part based on population, they're not going to be as happy with the settlement. Obviously, Michigan is in a different situation. We have over 10 million people in this state, but they did look at those other factors. So they didn't just look at the population. You know, they also looked at the number of pills that were dispensed into that state. They looked at the mortality rate, the number of people who had died in the state. So there were a number of different factors that were considered. But yeah, West Virginia is not going to get as much funding as a state like Michigan is. There's no question about that. But also there are other things to look at, right? Like we had Medicaid expansion in our state, and that allowed for a lot of people to be able to get into at least some form of drug treatment that was paid for as a result. Well, there are a lot of states, quite honestly, that did not participate in Medicaid expansion. And so it was harder for people to get drug treatment. And as a result, more people died. Well, I hate to say it, but whose fault is that? In a way, I think you can point to the state and say that there's more that they could have done to have helped people during that time period. So you're right. Not everybody is going to be happy about this. I think that Michigan is well served by this agreement. Of the total, we've actually done better than our population, but that's also because so many people were impacted. It doesn't matter your income level or your geography or your race. All classes of people in the state of Michigan were impacted by the opioid epidemic. And so this impacted everybody in our state. And that's why I'm so looking forward to seeing this money go, in many cases, directly to those municipalities that need it the most.
Attorney General Dana Nessel, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
In just a moment, we have to warn you, it's going to get hot in here. We're talking to the founders of Detroit's Black Pride Celebration, the second oldest of its kind in the nation, about the importance of being together right now. Be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Hotter than July, the annual celebration in Detroit is one of the oldest Black LGBT pride events in the United States. And this Saturday, it's returning as a hybrid, virtual, and in-person event. Hotter Than July is built in the history of the LGBT community in town, in the lives of people who made their own way, both openly and under the radar. With us today is Curtis Lipscomb. He's the founder of LGBT Detroit. Hey, Curtis.
Hey there.
We'd also like to welcome Jaron Totten. He is the organization's social research coordinator, its legislative advocacy specialist, and he also has his hand on the tiller of this year's event. Jaron, I guess a man of many hats, right?
Yeah. Good to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
And we have a special guest today, Mr. Robert Tate, an honoree at this year's event and lifelong Detroit resident and community volunteer. Mr. Tate, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Curtis, you founded LGBT Detroit, but I think it was KICK then, right?
You're absolutely right. It was. That was our first business name.
Do you want to tell the story about how things got started?
Sure. Back in the 90s, a lot of us were dying. HIV was rampant in gay and trans women experiences. And we wanted to create a space to honor and celebrate life. And one of the ways I thought to do was to share information about our well-being, share our contribution to the movement. And so our company was founded as a for-profit called KICK Publishing Company. And so we were in the print business, the print news business at that. We had a nice long run until the early 2000s. And we thought, you know, while we are doing this private industry, we thought, why don't we put our toes in the public industry, because we've been doing social justice work without knowing it, and started the nonprofit in 2003. We then changed our name to KIC, the Agency for LGBT African Americans. And that brought us on a very long journey. And in 2014, the board self-examined ourselves and thought, you know, I think we should be named as the movement sees us, LGBT Detroit. And it stuck and it's been working. That identity has helped us cut through the weeds and get to the real work. It's also increased our visibility. And so we're very happy to become LGBT Detroit.
Yeah, living in Detroit as a gay man in the 80s and 90s, you came across a community. I guess today we might say a safe space for Black people. And spaces created by people like Robert. Can you tell us how you first found these spaces and how you found your way into them?
With me, I belong to an organization called the Billionaire Boys Club. We was a dinner club. And we started about 34 years ago, I think in 1987. And we partnered up with a group called Men of Color. Our anniversary was during the time known now as Hotter Than July. And so in 2000, I started a company called Imagine This Production, and it was a benefit to raise money for the different organizations in the community.
Mr. Tate, what were the kind of spaces that you wanted to create, that you wanted people to have?
Well, we tried to create different events that we wanted to be part of, upscale events, and it turned out that's what the people wanted, something upscale, something that they wasn't normally doing. And so it turned out to be very, very successful. And still right today, the Billionaire Boys Club still does events, but they more so private. Imagine This Production is, I guess would say, is the live one that keeps things going and raising funds for the community.
Is this one of those situations where you had to invent the thing that you wanted and needed to be part of? Did you have spaces like that when you were a young man?
We had spaces, but back then, not realizing what we was doing, the way we was entertaining, it was going to turn out to something like this. We were just really having a good time creating our safe space for ourselves. But then we realized that other people wanted the same thing, so we branched out and just start serving the community through events and entertainment.
Yeah. What did community mean when you were a young person and sort of figuring out the path of your own life?
Well, when I say community, things was totally different back in the 70s and 80s than it is today. Back then, I guess we were more so, I guess, in the closet and not openly expressing ourselves as we do today. So it was a big difference back then and now.
For sure. Curtis, tell me about finding your way into some of those spaces and sort of how you met Robert.
Robert is a pillar of the community and he is an inspiration. Many of us who entered the space, particularly in the 80s, if you're young, relied on our big sisters and brothers to navigate us through what was to become a coming out experience that most of us have. In the 80s, many of us came out and unfortunately passed away without understanding the impact of HIV and understanding how to protect ourselves. And so while we are burying our dead and mourning our loss and trying to find our way, what Robert did was create space for us to celebrate. I remember meeting Robert Tate and being in awe of the kind of man that he was publicly. And I was just this young person, you know, just trying to find my way in activism. And I remember Robert Tate gave me an invitation to his stellar event, his Christmas party. I was so honored that he, one, knew my name, and two, that he welcomed me into his home in the Boston Edison District. It was the who's who of the LGBT community that would come to his home to see about 20 to 30 Christmas trees, a tree in every window of the house. And it was a magical weekend. And that was when I began to see Robert's commitment to the movement. And he had already given space to Hotter Than July and looked at the bigger picture. And so he's a father figure to many. He's a big brother figure to many. He's somebody who I want to be when I grow up. And I'm glad that he's the man that still is in spaces where young adults can see what it is to give of their time and what it is to hear stories about the movement. So they recognize that the movement started way, way a while ago. And so I'm very grateful for Robert's presence at LGBT Detroit and throughout our movement.
Mr. Tate, you were involved with Hotter Than July before it was even called that. Can you paint us a picture of what the early years were like?
Well, before Hotter Than July, like I said, I belonged to a group called the Billionaire Boys Club. And our anniversary was the last weekend in July. And it was something that we started back. We figured the social life was sort of dying down, no place to go. And so we created our own imagination of how we wanted to entertain ourselves. And from that point to today, it still exists. And I'm just so proud to be part of LGBT Detroit because I was so inspired when Curtis started the Kick magazine. And I said, oh, wow, this young man is going someplace. I'm going to hold on to his coattail. So right today, I'm still holding on to this coattail, and he got me doing radio interviews, and I didn't realize I was going to be doing that. I was just holding on to him, but I could keep current in what was going on in the community, and he just have just taken off like a rocket.
If you're just joining us today, my guests are Mr. Robert Tate, longtime community activist in Detroit. Also with us, we've got Curtis Lipscomb, founder of LGBT Detroit, and we're talking with Jaron Totten, who has several roles with the organization, but who is steering this year's Hotter Than July. Hey, Jaron, you're a little newer to the scene in Detroit, but you have produced events here, quite a few already, and I'm just wondering, what do you notice as, you know, the character of the community and the hallmark of all the times that folks like Mr. Tate and Curtis have lived through?
Well, first, let me say thank you for having me today. I'm very glad to be here. I'm originally from North Carolina, and I've been in Detroit for 2 years. I first visited Detroit in 2017 to aid a person who was running for Detroit City Council, as the majority of my background has been in political organizing. And immediately, I noticed how Southern adjacent Detroit is. Everyone is very friendly, like down south. You feel like you're at home amongst family in the community here. And that was something that was very attractive to me. Even before I knew I would move here for work. And so it's been an amazing experience so far.
Southern adjacent. I really love that. It kind of speaks volumes. So this weekend's Hotter Than July. We knew of this as a festival event with live performances and vendors in the before time, but there's always been a lot more to it than that. What do you have planned for this year? What can people expect?
This year, we have a wonderful lineup. We've had an amazing team of people, both who work here at LGBT Detroit, in addition to an entire volunteer team of community organizers who have helped us develop Hotter Than July this year and in previous years. And so on Friday, July 23rd, we have three events. Every year, all 26 years, we have begun with the Candlelight Vigil. You've heard Curtis talk about how those who attended Pride came to mourn their dead. And so every year we memorialize those that we have lost. This year, we've placed special emphasis on those we've lost due to the COVID-19 pandemic, as our hearts and minds still go out to families impacted by COVID. That will be at 11 a.m. on Friday. And then at 12 noon, our sister organization, LGBT Detroit Mobilization, it is our 501c4 side. And for those that don't know, a 501c4 is a nonprofit organization that can endorse political candidates. And so they will announce their slate formally to the public, and you will get to hear from those candidates that LGBT Detroit Mobilization has endorsed and their platforms. That will happen again on Friday at noon. And then we conclude Friday's activities with a live Hotter Than July art show. So all of these events will be streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and at hotterthanjuly.org.
Jaron, you mentioned the fact that there have always been moments of pride that are about mourning those who've gone before.
Yes.
And, you know, there has been a somber note in how we observe. But at the same time, I mean, we're coming off the pandemic, too. People have been cooped up for a very long time now. What is your sense of where people's heads are and what they need right now and how they want to celebrate?
We very much understand, after the year that we've had, the desire to be together again. And we very much hope that next year that we can return to an in-person celebration. Our reality is our area is less than 50% vaccinated. And so we did not think it would be the best thing to do to convene 10,000 people when probably only 4 out of 10 are vaccinated, thus putting a lot of people at risk of contracting COVID-19. And so what we do have in person are our testing zones. And these testing zones, in spite of the COVID-19 pandemic, have been expanded. In addition to the HIV and STD testing that Hotter Than July has offered free of charge to the community all 26 years, we've expanded this testing zone to now offer COVID-19 testing as well as COVID-19 vaccines. And so while we won't gather everybody to party, we do encourage everyone to get vaccinated. And so we try to make that clear as we roll out these pop-up vaccination sites during Hotter Than July. Speaking of, those will occur in Palmer Park and at Backstreet at Large. At Palmer Park, you can go and get your vaccine. You don't have to sign up on Friday, July 23rd, and Saturday, July 24th from noon to 5. And then at Backstreet at Large, which is a bar on Livernois, Friday and Saturday from 8 to 10. And so that was what was concerning to us regarding having an in-person celebration this year. But we do want to encourage everyone to please get your vaccine.
Yeah. So you planned with all of that in mind, trying to feed both sides of what people are dealing with right now. The vaccination opportunities, the candlelight vigil, the Sunday worship service, but also the virtual picnic, the Imagine This brunch that Mr. Tate has hosted for so many years. And I see, not to mention, the Cold as Hell event, especially for the kink community. I guess that's always been the name of it, right? Is having to meet people where they are, wherever they are.
Meeting people where they are and just showing the many different facets of this community and really changing narratives about what it is to be Black and gay and to tell stories of what it is to live in that intersection.
Yeah. Curtis and Mr. Tate, I do have one question for you. We all know that there have been folks from time to time who left the city because they felt a tension between their identity as part of Black Detroit and also who they are as queer Detroiters. With events like Hotter Than July, how does gathering together signal to people that there are ways for them to stay?
To me, when people leave Detroit to go other places, but I find it very, very interesting when we have something big coming to Detroit. Everybody loved Detroit. They always want to come back to Detroit, but I guess Detroit have a stigma on it where everybody think it's so bad and they leave and everything. But when visitors come, they don't see that. And they enjoy the city and always want to come back and they tell friends. And each year we get a different group of visitors that comes to Detroit, especially for the Hotter Than July event.
And if I may add, one of the things about Black Pride is to celebrate who we are and where we are. And Hotter Than July celebrates what is unique to be LGBT, a Southeast Michigan resident, a Midwesterner, primarily a social conservative member of the community. And so how we celebrate, what we celebrate is uniquely us. As Robert said, that's very attractive to many when you go to other places across the nation and see Hotter Than July in its unique way of celebrating. We're very different than any other celebration across the nation. Our friends tell us this. This is not just me boasting, but that is the truth. Many people leave Detroit for a number of reasons. It could be for personal reasons, for their children, economic reasons. Detroit has gone through a number of changes within the 20th century alone. In the late 20th century, primarily HIV and AIDS ravished our community. And so there's a number of reasons why someone depart. But as Robert said, there are many more reasons why people return. And as we see now, there's a number of reasons why people invest in Detroit. As long-term residents, such as myself and Robert, we've always seen its beauty. And so Holidays in July is curated to celebrate what is uniquely us for us.
Curtis Lipscomb is the founder of LGBT Detroit. We've also been talking with Jaron Totten, who is one of the leads on this year's festival, Hotter Than July. We've also been talking with Mr. Robert Tate, who's one of the honorees at this year's events. Gentlemen, it has been such a pleasure. I really, really appreciate that you took some time to talk to us.
It's an honor for me.
Thank you.
And it's a pleasure for me as well.
Next up, singer-songwriter Matthew Milia cools it down for us. What if yacht rock came from a pontoon boat?
On this record, I definitely did not shy away from like sort of a 90s, almost pop country sound of what I might hear on a boat radio in Sylvan Lake in the 90s.
Bust out the cooler. We're going to hear cuts from his new record, Kego Harbor, in just a moment. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's easy to romanticize cities and soundscapes like L.A. and New York, the places where dreams are supposed to come true. But singer-songwriter Matthew Milia's latest album name checks Bloomfield Hills and Orchard Lake. You know Matthew is the frontman for the band Frontier Ruckus, but he's just released a solo album titled Kego Harbor that's definitely one of our summer spins.
Someday I think I'll move back to Kego Harbor. Rent an upstairs room where the pear trees bloom for the barber that I used to see since the...
There's a pop country sound here, painting a picture of Milia's childhood and a lingering fondness for it today. Matthew Milia, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
The title song on the record repeats the lyric, "Someday I think I'll move back to Kego Harbor." Is that true sometimes? Do you ever get that feeling?
It's definitely an inclination I have. I'm not sure it's something I will indulge or would be the healthiest thing to, but it obviously comes from an overwhelming sense of nostalgia for a simpler time, which is childhood. I've just always kind of been drawn to narratives that use very specific places to tell kind of like generational tales. So my parents met in a small bar in Kego Harbor called the Backseat Saloon, and it's no longer there. But, the record uses Kego Harbor as this kind of metaphor for emotional inheritance, good and bad, the things that generational fears of triumph and existential dread and guilt.
All the stuff you get in suburbia. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So it's not a completely rose-tinted picture of the suburbs. It has to do with my complicated kind of relationship with suburbia.
What was a typical summer day like for kid Matthew growing up there?
Well, Kego Harbor is marked by, tons of inland lakes. So lots of wakeboarding, kneeboarding, sunburns, Capri Suns. On its surface, it does look like a 90s commercial.
There's a hilarious line in the song Sunburnt Landscapes that runs, "My therapist insists I need to let all of this go."
I want a list of every kid I used to know and their current careers. My therapist insists I should let all this go from my formative years.
It's a bit of a clue that while we're getting a beautiful sepia-toned memory, it was maybe not all bliss, yes?
Right. Yeah, like I said, it's complex feelings, and it's a very personal record where I kind of show that the conflict, the internal conflict I feel right on the page, the good and the bad. It was very important for it to be very transparent and vulnerable all the way through.
We're just sunburned landscapers from the trashier towns on the
love
always abounds.
The album art is a photo of you and I think your wife, Lauren, yes?
Yes.
And you're all dressed up in grown-up clothes. You got the sweater vest and the tie for you and the sort of Sunday best dress for her. It looks sort of like 80s drag, I guess. Is that you two dressing up as your grown-up selves?
Yes. Well, I mean, the record really deals with those conflicted notions of age. Like, how am I supposed to feel at this age? What does it mean to be an adult? When's the official barrier of adulthood? Because you find, as you actually grow up, that there isn't one, that it all blurs together into this kind of, like, confused sea of emotion. And I think we're actually dressed like our parents might have been in the 80s, because, like I said, it's all about generational sort of nebulous feeling. Am I my parents, or have I become something different?
I was thinking, I mean, you two got married, I want to say, just before lockdown?
Yes, so we literally got married a few weeks before the pandemic shut everything down. So this is 100% of a pandemic record.
It must have felt like playing house.
So I'm currently in the studio where we recorded the record, and it's all thanks to Ben Collins, this amazing engineer and producer, having everything just within his house. So, like, you know, an old 80s tape machine that we recorded everything through. And, you know, lots of Walgreens COVID tests, but we got things, we eventually got there.
Wow. Well, at least, I mean, it doesn't feel like you stinted on the production process. The album has a very lush sound, but at the same time, it's good to hear that it wasn't sort of a typical studio experience with tons of people kind of hanging around and in and out.
Yeah, I mean, the actual process was so intimate. We're literally locked in this little room, but Ben is so proficient at making it sound bigger than that and grandiose and kind of, I mean, that's what the record is about, taking the mundanity of a place like Eagle Harbor and glorifying it. So he did that sonically. It's a testament to the players that I brought in. It's such a Michigan record. I mean, Ben's from amazing Michigan bands like Mini Horse and Lightning Love. We have on piano a great, my old friend and pianist Ryan Hay from the Grand Rapids band Pink Sky. And the steel guitar, which is profuse throughout the record, and my favorite part was this legendary steel player named Pete Ballard, who I've idolized for like over a decade. So, and my wife Lauren provides lush harmonies that add such an emotional completion for the record.
Laurel Canyon via Keego Harbor.
That is beautiful. I want to put, can I put that on the sticker for the cover?
100%.
Yeah, that is so good. There's something, it does definitely have that breezy kind of 70s Laurel Canyon, but it's also like yacht rocky at some time. So it's funny because Keego Harbor, you know, it's marked by all these inland lakes, but it almost takes on a kind of breezy seaside vibe at times.
If you're just joining us, my guest is singer-songwriter Matthew Milia. His new record is called Keego Harbor. You know, I'm glad you bring up yacht rock. I wouldn't put this record in that particular bin per se, but I have to ask you, have you heard the John Mayer record?
I've heard it's very 80s and pastiche kind of, right? It has it's almost like a Don Henley record. Yeah, I've heard snippets.
The guy even put, speaking of album cover stickers, like the presentation even includes that round graphic design, the nice price that we all used to find on the records that we would get in the bargain bins at the dime store. It amazes me. Of all the music I could have foreseen coming out of the pandemic, you know, sort of a sun-drenched summer sound is not what I would have predicted out of everyone. What's that about?
Well, as you know, someone who works in advertising for my day job, I do very much appreciate that commitment to that aesthetic. But I would say hard times traditionally and historically have produced a hyperbolically exuberant sound. If you look at like the 40s or 50s coming out of World War II, some of the most hyperbolically happy sounding music. But for me personally, I've always loved mingling hyper-melodic, catchy, upbeat sounds with sometimes rather lugubrious lyricism, which I'm drawn to. I love that kind of contradiction. I love the emotional conflict it provides. So on this record, I definitely did not shy away from like sort of a 90s almost pop country sound of what I might hear on a boat radio in Sylvan Lake in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It just kind of provides a balance to the very heavy topics I'm trying to convey.
The lead track, Salad Bars, is right in that wheelhouse. It's pretty much a nostalgic summer song turned 45 degrees to the side. And the lyrics talk about the way that strip mall restaurants and junk mail offer us strong reminders of how impersonal life can be, and especially suburban life, but also reminds us that they can still be comforting.
Candy corn in an empty car. You still mourn the brand new start that ended with a broken heart. Yeah, we know.
To ask if you have a particular favorite piece of junk mail you've ever received.
that song really deals with sort of unwelcome reminders of mortality and getting life insurance pamphlets every other, now that I'm on the other side of 35. I just love injecting songs with that sort of specificity that it seems almost too particular to work at times, but I believe in a sort of paradox where the universal is very much housed in those specific triggers.
Are there things about yourself that at this ripe old age and as a as a grown-up married man, things that you recognize about yourself that you now see are there in you because of where you grew up and how you grew up? I wondered if there's a song on the record that you think kind of might bring that quality home the most.
That's a very great question. Keogh Harbor is found between, you know, West Bloomfield and Pontiac. So it's kind of in the suburban no man's land of late capitalist infrastructure. And the American dream is very much alive in this sort of desperate sense. And I grew up in this, you know, middle class that on the verge of hoping it can maybe become upper middle class lifestyle. You know, living in the Pontiac School District, but going to private schools, my parents struggling to send me there. But that sort of American dream is just such an entrenched part of my DNA. And it's funny, coming out of 10 years as a professional touring musician, a lot of this record is about recalibrating one's dreams and expectations and wishes. Like, what's going to make me happy? Is it all these things that I was told that I need, these material items? Or is it finding a simpler, more pure sense of oneself and purpose, which at this record, Keogh Harbor kind of represents that return to a simpler sense of self and one's life work, what's going to fulfill you.
Mm-hmm. So, like you say, I mean, you've had these phases in your life as a touring musician, and yet here you are now, married and living in Detroit, working at an ad agency, kind of Dick Van Dyke / Don Draper life. Do you feel like you've made it?
I've made it in that I know what makes me happy better than I ever have, which is not having to worry about how I'm going to pay the bills or rent, which is a luxury and a privilege in 2021. But also I know that show business is not, as I thought it would for so long, what will ultimately fulfill me. I toured for 10 years. In search of some carrot that ultimately kind of made me miserable. But what does fulfill me is just writing simple songs about very specific places. It's a very niche enterprise, but it brings me boundless pleasure and gratification to just write about my weird local world with kind of boundless specificity.
Yeah. What are you up to now that things are opening up a bit?
My wife and I, Lauren, just went down to Mexico City for a delayed honeymoon.
Whoa.
In very Michigan fashion, though, the day that we left, we realized that our entire basement was flooded knee high, and we lost pretty much the entirety of my band Frontier Ruckus's vinyl merch inventory.
Oh. So,
Luckily, we were able to put it out of our minds for the most part and enjoy Mexico City.
The impermanence of life, you were saying? Something about
yes.
Something about reminders of mortality?
Daily reminders.
Well, Matthew Milia, thank you so much for talking to us. The new record is called Kigo Harbor. We're looking forward to listening to it in whatever form we can.
It was so fun. Thanks for having me.
It's keeping life's hard, but giving up's even harder. And I'm not ready to die. I'll just go simplify in Kigo Harbor.
In Celine. Curious celebrity watchers have been flocking to town to see who? Was it Bruce Springsteen casing venues for a tour? Cardi B looking for that quiet prenatal getaway? It's actually a bird.
Well, it's a roseate spoonbill, and it's called that because of the shape of its bill, which among North American birds is totally unique to that species.
The juvenile roseate spoonbill was spotted this week in Wilderness Park. Word got out on ebird.com, because the internet, and before you know it, bird watchers were coming to Celine from hundreds of miles away. Pamela Rasmussen is an assistant professor of integrative biology at Michigan State University. I asked her if she knows what the heck this thing is doing here.
What it's doing in Michigan, well, no one really knows, but there is a pattern of young roseate spoonbills, and this is a young bird. There's a pattern of them traveling, you know, in their first summer. So they head north. Only a few of them do, but still, it's enough to make this pattern because they're really obvious. You can't mistake them for anything else, and they don't hide. So they're, you know, when they show up, people know it generally. Yeah, so the young ones, for whatever reason, do explore. And then we don't know what happens after that, whether they just go back home and set up shop, you know, along the Gulf Coast or what.
Pam, can you lay out where this bird is normally found?
Well, it's got a wide range from the Gulf Coast of the U.S. And it's really common in Florida, for example, and you can see them in Louisiana or, you know, the Gulf Coast of Texas. And you can see them in various wetlands in Mexico through Argentina. So they do have a wide range. They're also in the Caribbean as well. And they do have a naturally wide range, but it's restricted to warmer climates and to wetlands.
Is there any reason to think that it might stay through colder seasons? I mean, could a spoonbill like this survive in Celine?
I don't think it could survive, and I don't think it will try, because the records that I've seen are all from the summer, for the northern states anyway. So they just don't do this in the winter. Mm. For one thing, there's no open water, but also I don't think that they're cold tolerant. A bird has to have special adaptations in order to survive in the winter in Michigan, and this bird does not have those, is my guess.
Do you have any thoughts on what might have caused this roseate spoonbill to fly to Michigan? I mean, should we chalk this up to a byproduct of climate change or just a really odd sense of direction?
Well, I don't think that this particular thing is due to climate change, because even though a lot of things that we're witnessing now obviously are, but not this, because there are records of young spoonbills in states near to Michigan from the 1800s. So they've been doing this for quite a while, and presumably for thousands of years, if not longer. So it could be that some individuals have a gene, a version of a gene that causes them to go exploring. And this could be adaptive in that it could lead to colonization of new areas. Or it could be that something went wrong in the navigational system that this bird possesses. So birds that migrate have complex navigational systems that have multiple components, depending on the species, but this is a day flying migrant species. And so they probably don't use the stars like some songbirds do. But anyway, something went wrong. Maybe just its perception of the magnetic field that allows it to distinguish north from south, etc. So something could have gone wrong, or it could have a gene that causes it to go exploring.
Pamela Rasmussen is an assistant professor of integrative biology at MSU and an assistant curator at the MSU Museum. That is Stateside for today. We'd like to raise a glass to the spoonbill and all the other drifters and flamingo wannabes out there this weekend. Get some rest. We'll see you Monday.